Okay, so I want to do some brief moments of introduction. One, as Daniel and Rachel recall, you should just be aware there are no tangents. So even if you don't see the immediate connection of everything we're doing, right, it's all holistic. So you just have to take it on faith. Right, eventually, somewhere in your life, but even if it sounds like I'm doing something totally unrelated to the main share, actually it's directly connected. It may take a whole lifetime. But in Reiku Mikem. Okay, I think it would be, first of all, inappropriate not to begin today by mentioning the death of Mijam Mital. I don't want to make an effort to give any kind of hesped, because I think there will be, Baruch Hashem, thousands and thousands of people vastly more qualified to do so than I. I was only privileged to meet him once, and that was, you know, just as one of the many, many anonymous people who happened to be in Har Etzion for Shabbos. And I hope we'll have Rabbi Helfgott on Shabbos, who can give a much more credible job. So I'm not going to talk about Rav Amital in the sense of trying to explain to you what he was in reality. What I do want to make is am I audible now? Sort of. What I do want to make is a broader point in a certain sense. One of the issues that I deal with a lot, I think that all of us need to think about, particularly to some degree those of us who define ourselves as being part of a tradition that prizes critical thinking, a school that prizes critical thinking and independence and all that, is what the meaning and value of tradition is. Why it matters to situate oneself in the context of Masoret, and how one situates oneself in the context of Masoret as an independent critical thinker who prizes creativity. I'll give you one autobiographical example of this, which I is that I went out of my way to be in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zichrono Livracha's shir, not because at that time in his life it was the best shir in the world, because there were moments where you could see that it had once been a spectacular shir, but at the time I was in a shir, that's what it largely was recollection of, right? There would be moments when he would recall the great shirim he had given in the past, but he wasn't any more capable of giving us a new brilliant shir, and there were spots. But I was into shir because I wanted to be able to situate myself as his Talmud, because I wanted to be, right, because so far as I knew then, now actually I have a little bit more optimistic vision, he was the only major Talmud Chacham who saw support for the civil rights movement in America as a religious obligation. Right, and I wanted to be able to say that this was not my chiddush, but that I was carrying on a masoret which understood that was central to Torah. And that matters a great deal to me. Not that Rav Aaron and I agreed about everything, whether in shir or out of it, but it matters to me to be able to make that, right, to be able to make that claim. So I think that Amital, for many of us, and while again I was not his Talmud, the whole chevra I moved in, right, were largely people, right, the people who were, right, who were direct, more direct Talmidim of him than I was. I think what Amital functioned for us was as the touchstone of the Masoret that Torah really, really had to accord with the best ethical instincts of human beings. Right? That it wasn't an imposition of an alien secular morality to start from the premise that Torah had to be beautiful in the ethical sense, and Torah had to, right, and it couldn't make sense for there to be something in Torah which you looked around and you said, well, any enlightened person would say, wow, that's evil. That just couldn't be. And there were all sorts of ways in which which that played out in the dialectic between Rav Amitel's instincts and Rav Lichtenstein's self-consciousness in some way. It's a very powerful thing for those of us who function in that orbit. But I think, I'll say personally, and I think that it's reflective of broad thing, that that's what Rav Amitel stood for that. Right, for that note, right, it was the gave us the confidence that when we said things like that, that can't be true. Right, that has to be true, because you couldn't possibly, Torah couldn't possibly mean that. I think it was knowing that, you know, and Rav Amitel thinks that way too. Right, that was right, that was a tremendously important thing for us, and it's an enormous loss for Klal Yisrael when you don't have someone living that you can point to and say, right, you can point to and talk and say, there is a Talmud Chacham of unbelievable stature who grounds us when we make fundamental statements about our Hashkafa. And it's difficult to be right to say more in praise of somebody than that they can function as that kind of touchstone without any with full confidence that they right that you were not constructing a legend for your own purposes, but you were actually genuinely point right you were generally grounding yourself in something real. That's personal perspective. Again, it's secondhand, and those of you who were privileged to be with Talmidim, I encourage you to find occasion over Shabbos to share concrete reminiscences and lots of Torah over the over Shabbos. If I unfortunately my copy of the English book is in my office at Gann, so I'm sticking to my regularly played shir. I thought about just trying to dafka teach Rav Amitel Torah as well as I could today, but didn't feel competent. But I encourage those of you who can do it off the cuff more. Okay, so I don't have internet access here. That's all right. So I don't have the. But I hope that we'll spend time over Shabbos and forever, making sure that his Torah survives and spreads. Okay, then there are times when there's no question when a masoret is deliberately constructed. You can construct it in different ways, right? You know, one way. As I say, so for me, you know, I constructed a Masorah of the Varan Soloveitchik consciously by saying, I wish to be part of this tradition, and so I went to his shir, and I'm not saying anything artificial when I say I'm a Talmud of Varan Soloveitchik, because I sat in his shir, Dafka, with the purpose of becoming, right, becoming his Talmud, and we'll say he was his Talmud. Now, when it comes to Rav Meir Shapiro, that's a little bit more, that's, you know, an interesting thing for me. It's a family Masorah. My grandfather, Alav HaShalom, my father's father, was a Talmud of Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, and so as I mentioned it earlier, I feel sort of much more ethnically than theologically Hasidic. But in terms of what, you know, if there is a family Masoret of Talmud Torah, that's where it comes from. It comes from the association with Meir Shapiro. So I enjoy when I can pulling out a vort from Meir Shapiro, even though I never heard a vort from Meir Shapiro from my grandfather. So this is entirely constructed Masoret. It's not like I'm going, you know, going through the family that way. So this the first time that I looked at anything but Meir Shapira was in preparing for the Shloshim for my grandfather, and I came across the Sefer, and there was a vort which was very useful in the context of a Hesped, and I used it in that context at the shir I gave for the Shloshim. But I realized as I was rereading it, preparing for a hesped for my uncle last month, that it was also a useful counterpoint to a text I had often taught, and a text I probably taught unfairly, as I realized when I reread it last week preparing for this, which is a text by the Michtav Melio. So I want to read Meir Shapiro's piece as background for Rav Dessler, because then I'm going to argue that Rav Dessler takes a certain position for a very clear reason, and right, I'm going to try and say that there are really high stakes and whether one accepts or deaths with position or rejects it. But what I'm going to say is that in the past I have said this, I think, really starkly, and I've enjoyed, actually, I learned this from Destler for the first, probably 25 years ago, and I forgot it, and then Rabbi Yitzi Blau reminded me about 15 years ago already. He said, where's that Rav Destler that you used to talk about? And I remember that Rav Destler. I went back and found it. I've been using it ever since. But then I spent some time last couple of weeks reading other pieces of Rav Destler and thought maybe I'm not being fair. And I thought maybe a good way of putting Rav Destler in context, which might give you the capacity to evaluate better whether I was being fair or not, was to see something of the same idea in Rav Meir Shapiro. So we're in the Meir Shapiro piece. So what he says is that when he begins to prepare Shiurim and Pirkei Avot, right, he wonders why you have this statement about, right, basically a self-referential statement, Baruch Shebachar Bahem B'Mishnatam B'Siyam Mesechet Shel Avot. Right, why do we say that line when we finish? At the beginning of the sixth chapter, Baruch Shebachar Behem Mishnah Tam. Blessed is God who chose them and their Mishnah. So he says, V'an V'omar. So I say in response, Im B'chol HaTalmud Yeshno Miuchad Kol Devar L'Shem Omro. All right. If throughout the Talmud there is a point to, right, there's a purpose, there's a focus on saying everything B'Shem Omro. Never resist this point. Who knows who said, "Kol Omer Devar B'Shem Omro, maybe Gula L'Olam." Do you know anybody else? Should look it up.
I know the joke.
You should look it up. Everybody should look. It feels like it should be pointed out every time until we get it right. Do you know?
I think it's the Rebbe Elazar B'Shem Rebbe Hanina.
I'll look it up. I don't think so, but we'll have to find it.
I
don't
get it wrong because I have a
mental. It's a fun thing. It's a fun thing. Okay, so he says, Yeshu is the Erech Miuchad. It's a particular value in assigning statements to their authors. Kedei l'kvo halacha l'dorot, because that establishes halacha. Echuvar b'mesechet idiot, lama nishnu v'chulei. L'chahane kvali d'kali lab mesechet erevin, etc. Okay, so the whole... Right, there are rules of Kloli Hora.
Is that Rabbi
Elazar B'Shem Rabbi Hanina? Is he right? Four. Good for you.
Now I finally
all places, or does it appear in more than one place?
That's the first one I found. That was in Megillah.Tetzav.
Bravo.
One of my friends challenged me to remember it.
I thought it was the second version, but okay. Okay, thank you, Xavier. So we understand why it is important to...
In the Sabbath school, it's Rabbi Yossi.
Ah, okay.
We have a long standing Torah of not knowing.
Yeah. There may also be Girsa issues in the Gemara and the Megillah. So we understand why it's important to know who said what lehalacha, because authority in the tradition is based on who somebody, right, and who said what, right? It gives Rabbi Elazar Yaakov wins, Rabbi Akiva beats one wins one on one, those things. But he says, v'chol ze ras pehalachot sheshayach pehem plukta umachloket. All this applies only to halachot, where the category of disagreement is relevant. But that is not true about the nature of the quiddity of Masechet Avot. Velo Avot Musag Acher Lagamrei. Avot is an entirely different category. Shinun Midot, right, the sharpening or the teaching of character. Umusar LeAdam. Ve'ein Shum Machloket Bin HaTanaim. Rak Kol Echad Maskir Mida Acheret. Okay, so when it comes to Shinun Midot and Musar, there is no dispute among the Tanaim, and Pirkei Avot does not ever explicitly record disputes, as far as I know of, except for, I guess, Eza Midah Tova, right, ever, but generally, right? Generally, right, the statements are framed, without being contextualized by other statements. You can construct the question of whether there's a dispute about which three things the world really depends on, and things like that. But it's almost never framed as, he says this, but he disagrees. Right. So the question is, why does, right?
The question is, which is the most important Mida?
I said, like that four, right? Like, Ezovi. Right. Shaul, Rabbi Yochanan, Zakeh, Talmida. Right, there are a few cases like it, but Bichlal, generally not. That's not the nature of Avot. And yet, Avot goes out of its way. Everything is said by, right? Avot is a really good Masechta at assigning everything to a name, right? There's just about no Stam in Avot. So why is that? So he goes off, and his answer is that the authority of the significance of such statements depends on personality, and we get to Lomidrasha Ikare Le Maaseh, which some of you may recall. Well, that's come up recently, right? And other statements like that. I'm actually not going into that now. I just want to read that opening statement, right? Shinun Midot Musar Ladam Ve'Ein Shum Machloket Ben Hatanaim Rak Kol Echad Maskir Mida Acheret. Okay, there's no dispute, rather just each one mentions a different trait. Okay, now I want to move to Rav Dessler. Right? I want to have that text in the back of your minds, the front of your minds. I'm going to read Rav Dessler and see what Rav Dessler says. Okay, so this is a letter called Machloket Chazal, which is apparently written on a boat on the way to America. That's interesting. Right? It's also the beginning of Parshas Noach. It's got to be fun to be on a boat. the beginning of Parshas Noach. So he writes to various students. Kishichnasti l'sfina. Right, when I entered the boat, I found there were all sorts of letters, and I've been busy, and so I couldn't really write the letters. The whole story about how I was supposed to leave earlier, but I had to wait until after the Yom Noraim, and I learned from that Musar Haskel that I shouldn't have tried to leave Yeshiva before the Yom Noraim. Okay. We're at the ellipsis. U'masha sha'altem biur ha-gemara bivrachot lamadalvim abed. Ko ha-nevi'im kulan lo nabu el lavalei tshuva. All prophets only prophesized for lavalei tshuva. Aval tzedekim gemurim ayin l'ra'ata elohim zolotecha. But tzedekim gemurim, only God has seen, meaning that the future prepared, the reward prepared, the end prepared for Tariqin Gemurim, the prophets have not even described. And God hasn't let anybody see that in advance. Upligi Rabbi Avo, right, and this disagrees, right, with the statement of Rabbi Avo, Damar Makom Shabalei Tshuva Amdim Tariqin Gemurim Enam Amdim. So Rabbi Avo gave the impression that the Balei Tshuva are further in or further up or whatever you want than the Tariqin Gemurim in the hierarchy of heaven, and therefore, if the prophets describe the place of Balei Tshuva, then obviously, in order to get to the place of Balei Tshuva, you would pass through the place of Tzadikim Gemurim, and you would have seen it. All right, so that's the fundamental. Right, so there's a dispute about which is more impressive.
I think there's a dispute about who is more impressive. But if like the Nevi'im didn't see only two of Balei Tshuva, that means Tzadikim were even higher than them, and other guys didn't.
Yeah, exactly right. Because right, so but you could interpret the psukim if you run. You have to connect the axis of who is greater with what the Nevi'im describe. Well, except you could claim, look, that Balei Tshuva are more valuable, but it happens in the Nevi'im skipped the lower thing and went straight to the higher thing. There has to be some reason why the Nevi'im couldn't have seen. Right, the Nevi'im would have to have seen it. That's all. Right, it's not important though. Just a literary thing. Okay. The Sha'altim, so you asked the question, Shahri Yesh L'Yashiv, right? Why is this presented with the term Mufligi? Right? Why is there a dispute among these? Shahri Yesh L'Yashiv, Demitzad Gilui Chasto Yisparach, Mitgal Yotzer B'Val Tshuva, that in terms of the revelation of God's Chesed, B'Val Tshuva, the place where B'Val Tshuva is a greater revelation of God's Chesed. Right? I'm not going to play out the mechanics of what revelation means and all that. It's not my expertise. But the worship itself is greater, right? Is more revealed in the tzaddik who has been a tzaddik all the way through. So why do we assume that these statements disagree? We just have to claim that they're talking about different aspects. Right? And I'm not interested right now in trying to nail down precisely what the aspect of chesed is as opposed to the aspect of avoda. You can probably do that better than I can. Okay. So he says is, Tzadakim b'divreichem me'od, your words are very true. V'hinei be'emet lo shayach machloket el b'dvar halacha. Really, machloket is not possible except with regard to halacha. V'gam b'zeh Rak benogela maase eichel asod. Even in halakha, the dispute is only possible in terms of what to do. Aval be'etzem tochan einyan, but in the right, in the essential content of the matter, lo shayach machloket, there is no possibility of machloket. And how do we know there's no possibility of machloket? Ki amram zichrono livracha, elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Right, this and right, these and those are both the words of God. Now, since God doesn't contradict Himself, therefore all statements must, at their core, right, at their core, cohere. Perish the shtei hadayot, right? So the explanation of this is that the two opinions, shnei mabatim emet, right? Both of these perspectives are true. Shnei emet, and both of them are true. The mashal, and so instead of using the mashal of the elephant, he uses the mashal of a piece of paper or any three-dimensional object, which is much broader in one dimension than the other. Where if you look at it, right, so he takes a piece of paper, right? If you look at it along this axis, it looks sharp. If you look at it on this axis, it looks broad and dull. And, right, and so two people coming from different perspectives, et cetera, right? It's cooler with an elephant. I don't know why he didn't use the elephant. Okay, but really, it's the same piece of paper. Right, and this is also the case of the machloket Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. Right, that really that each of them, right, the chol echad. Look at the end of the paragraph. The chol echad ra'ah et emet mitzad bechinat midato b'avodat Hashem yitbarach. Right, that each of them saw the truth from the perspective of their own midah. Vayin mashak hasav. Right, to write, see what Yisrael Salanter wrote, which I admit I haven't checked, so you have to look it up yourself. And he goes on to say, v'nei meforash b'tikunei zohar, which I also haven't checked. The binyanei agada v'kabla lo sheach machloket. V'abir kanal mishum d'shnei b'batim emet kol echad b'shchinato ve'eno chaluk l'maaseh. I'm not sure what that means there. And then he ends up right. He says that this is also right. V'ayin evan shlomo l'hagro binyanei mashiach d'shnei gidrei mashiach yesh ha'echad b'gilui gadol baruchniyot mashiach ben David v'asheni geula mishivat malchios levad mashiach ben Yosef. Umamari Chazal is so trimbezeh. I know the machlok is about whether the Yosef Mashiach will be totally supernatural, or whether Ein Ben Olamazel the Yosef Mashiach Ela Shibud Malchiyot Bilvad. The only difference is political freedom. So right. So he says the Gra says that actually that's not a machloket, even though the Gemara says Ufligi. Really, the Gemara, right Shmuel's statement Ein Ben Olamazel the Yosef Mashiach Ela Shibud Malchiyot Bilvad is talking about Mashiach Ben Yosef. And the other statements which set up the Yimotzeh Mashiach as a supernatural era, right, those are talking about Mashiach ben David. Okay, so, right, he says, v'lechora, right, how could the Gra have said it? V'lechora t'mua, sh'arei sh'af aruchu v'megemar le'el b'vrachu, b'kanhedrin v'shvuos, v'od mekamos kimdimani, t'chol ha'nevim lo nidnabu el Yimotzeh Mashiach v'chulei, u'fligi. Right, they disagree, Shmuel, right, with Shmuel, d'amar, Ein ben olam azeli mos meshech leshud malchus bilvad. El al korchacha kanechtav leel dehay ufligi haynu shtei bechinot chalukot hein begula. And I think I've seen this already. Okay. So I want to present this the way I used to, but with the proviso that I'm not at all sure anymore that I'm being fair to Rav Dessler when I do this. But I think the point itself has value, and then we'll figure out if it's fair to Rav Dessler. Why would you want to say, right, why is it so important to believe that there is no machloket in Agadah? Yes, Elliot.
At least from what the Rabbi has said, it seems that there might be, you don't want there to be a dispute about what are the values of Judaism, just how to apply those values.
Good. Why does that matter? Right. Why? Why does it matter to you? If we're willing to disagree about the halacha, and willing to say that people disagree about what you ought to do, right? So why does it matter so much to say that nobody, right? That nobody disagrees about values?
Because what Judaism is based
on. So, and halacha.
Halacha under practical application.
So why is it more important, right? It's fine that we can really think that what you're doing is wrong. But we can't think that you're doing it because you have the wrong values. Why? Why does that matter?
Because we don't want people to have the wrong values.
And we do want people to do the wrong thing?
Yeah.
Right. So okay. Right. So why? Right. Right. Why is it so? If I'm willing to believe that really you should have done X and you did Y, and all right, you know, because we don't know what we can't be sure what to do. Right. So why is it that I'm so unwilling to believe that you right that you did it that when you made that mistake, you made that mistake because why is it I'm unwilling to say that halacha, a machloket in halacha can't reflect a real division about what matters. Right, that's what I'm trying to push. Okay, Danny, what do you want to say?
Well, I suppose there's got to be some value in us not wanting to have to say that everybody has competing understandings of Torah. Like it's in order that the subject matter that they're working with itself is different. One is we want to be able to say that we're all working off the same thing, that when we make a choice in love, it's not like redefining Torah itself. It's just maybe what a person brings to how I understand it is not correct or whatever.
Interesting formulation. I'm going to let it sit and we'll try to see what other people, because I think we're going to end up having to triangulate to get it. Right, Roy, what do you want to say?
I was interested in Torah, but that's more extreme. I think that for halacha is what we should do. So I think that he accepts there might be a disagreement on what we should do. But Agadah is just a description of reality. And you can't have two contradicting, you can't have contradicting descriptions of reality. I think that's what he sees.
You can't spoil it when you're wrong.
Right.
But he doesn't want to
see,
you know, okay, so you think he's worried that the claim that we can disagree about values means that Judaism has no essential content.
Well, he's worried that will be
there. Are people, it's a slippery slope, right? If you believe that there's any possibility of disagreement, then right, then you could disagree with anything.
Yeah,
and then Judaism has no essential content. Okay.
Just take a fundamental issue with anything, and then, of course, he probably himself also has personal, very strong convictions about what Judaism philosophically is, and this is a great way for him to say that is Judaism. Right,
without anyone else to say, no, maybe I have a different way of doing it.
You know, this is a very attractive position to someone who has a very strong philosophy of
David, what do you
want
to say?
Well, I want to be exceptionally cynical. I would say
politicizing
against modern orthodoxy.
Uh-huh.
So I think modern orthodoxy often has this notion that we tolerate a plurality of hashkafas as long as you toe the line on halacha. And he wants to say, no, you know, there's room for plurality in halacha, but there's only one Torah Tzur Hashkafa.
I think in historical context, he's probably not really that.
Well, it's, they were, 59 years ago. I don't know.
The real, like, rate.
I don't know. It said Ron, yeah.
Yeah, it's I think when he describes the machloket, he discusses from outside. He is aware that the Balei Machloket thinks that I think he's wrong, and I think he's wrong. I, Rav Leo Dessler, can describe from many years after Haita Machloket, there is no Machloket. But they think they have Machloket, that's the first thing they think. And the other thing, he describes a given tradition, a given sources. When I say, En ben she'abuza, en ben imot ha-mashiach ha-olam hazeh, she'abuz malchuyot, and other things, ani be'emet cholek al Shmuel. I really disagree with Shmuel. So, כשהוא מתאר מציאות נתונה ומצב נתון ואת המקורות, הוא אומר אין מחלוקת, אבל it doesn't mean that when I say another thing, אני באמת אין לי מחלוקת, כי באמת I have a disagreement with him.
Well, is it true? He doesn't know מחלוקת in Chazal.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't, right? That's part, that's a point against the polemic thesis, right? Because he doesn't deny the possibility of real disputes post-Chazal, necessarily.
Right, but there might be real disputes post-Chazal, but then one of them is just not Torah true.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There has to be an essential ideology of Judaism, and it has to be a habit, you know, with that desire.
We are completely monolithic in our Ashkapa.
Okay. Maish, what do you want to say?
I think Rav Dessler is basing his perspective on the reality, which is very rooted in Chassidut and Kabbalah. You know, it's stressed there, even though it's definitely present in Kol HaTorah Kulo, that truth exists between two poles, you know, between two polar opposite values, both of which can be true, and the truth is only found by including both of those values and finding balance. So I think what he's saying is that each opinion independently would not be truth, because it would be to the exclusion of the opposite pole. So meaning, none of these truths independently are true. They are only truths when you take into consideration their opposite opinion. And why that wouldn't apply to halacha is just because, you know, that's one step down, where we're finding the balance of truth, which, you know, halacha, we're constantly trying to, you know, you'll even find people trying to be yotzei both opinions, you know, but when it comes to the halacha, like, all right, like, we need to do one way, you know, or we need to balance both as well.
Okay, good. So Maish points out, I'm going to paraphrase it very correctly, is that the argument that there is only one truth can be an exclusionary argument, which is what some of you argued, right? It's a way of saying there's only one truth and there's not it. And it can also be an inclusionary argument, and here's the easy way to make this argument in a very non-Orthodox context. We usually make it through a sadigon. Right? All truth comes from God. Therefore, you can't claim that there's a sharp distinction between Torah and science, between Torah and philosophy, right? Because if philosophy and science are true, then they're Torah. Right, and
there's no Hester to learn them in the bathroom.
This is Clafford. I have this dispute regularly about the problem whether if one takes the position that all truth is Torah, so is one allowed to do anything of substance whatsoever in the bathroom, or not, because it should all be Torah. You know, her test case usually is astronomy textbooks, right, or biology textbooks. No, but the way we always argue about it is, what happens if you have a tshuva, and the tshuva begins by quoting the first 50 pages of a biology textbook? And am I allowed to read those 50 pages of the tshuva, right, of the tshuva in the bathroom? What happens if the tshuva doesn't quote it, just says, ayin, bit? Right, so does that, right, so if I'm reading that textbook as a footnote to the tshuva, am I allowed? Now, that's a real problem, because I don't read anything without relating it to something, right, because my mind doesn't set up barriers that way, so maybe I can't learn science in the bathroom because I'm always going to think about it in relationship, right, or literature in relationship to something else. So I try to argue that there's a difference between, and this is a word from Professor Bernstein and Jonathan. All right, Jonathan was quoting earlier that he used to say that he was makbid that in his undergraduate classes in Tanakh, every class, if a student made a Birkas HaTorah walking in, it should not have been a bracha but levatala walking out. In his graduate classes, he wasn't makbid that way. Now, of course, he thought that he was teaching Torah, you know, in some way or sense all the way through, but there's a difference between formal Torah and informal Torah. I think that, I'm willing to maintain, you know, so I am perfectly happy to say that I think that there is deep religious purpose and in some sense a kiyum talmud Torah in learning certain forms of science, but I don't think you make a bracha on them. Another way of framing it is, I don't know that there's any miskiyum in learning science that you know in advance to be wrong. But there might be a kiyum in learning a position halakha that you know we don't paskin like. There is, I think.
Why do we feel the need to make everything in the Talmud Torah?
Why do you feel the need to do lots of different things in the bathroom?
I'm far more comfortable just saying I can accept value to something which is not Talmud Torah.
Okay, it's another way of framing it, but you have to cover our side you're going, right? So it comes from God, right? So then the question of why we care about whether it being Torah, right? If all MS is Chosama Shalakadosh Baruch Hu, so it's just a semantic dispute whether I call it Torah or not.
And if I can't study it without thinking about God, maybe it's not me, I shouldn't study it.
Well, that's a whole, right? So that's a rough question, but really, no, but if you have a particular kind of personality, then there isn't anything you can study.
about thinking about God, so that, you know, then you get into, I love the Kurt Vonnegut story, right, where it's a great egalitarian society, the ballet dancers have to wear heavy, have to wear cannonball shackles to their legs, and the smart people wear earphones but shoot white noise. So the only way you can create a really egalitarian society is where you can't make awkward people graceful, and you can't make dumb people smart, but you can make graceful people awkward, and you can make smart people dumb. That's what they do. Physical handicaps on the graceful, and intellectual handicaps on the smart. It's a very, very sharp short story. Okay. So, I think that's a fair and powerful point, that that arguments for the unity of truth, right, and for there only being one truth can also be, right, if you start with a reasonably open mind, they're a way of justifying multiple epistemologies, right? Well, that looks like it contradicts. So what? Right? There are ways in which it can be, right? This could be a polemic against the exclusion of unorthodoxy, right? Use the text that way too. Right? So those of you guys who think, well, look, unorthodoxy contradicts that Torah. Well, that's only because you're looking at non-orthodoxy from this perspective. If you're looking from this perspective, you would see that it's perfectly compatible, right? Right? I think you can use it either way. I think historically it's unlikely that Jester was using it that way. Even less likely that he was using it as a polemic against whatever non-orthodoxy meant back then. But I think it's absolutely right that that's a legitimate reading of the story, and that's going to be part of the...
It's also been a polemic against religious Zionism.
Or for.
Why does it need to be for?
Right? Rav Kook could say this.
Because I'm trying to be as cynical as possible. I preface my remarks with that.
Dear George, what do you want to say?
I'm trying to think of it in terms of if we allow Chazal to vary on, like, this one has one value and that one has a different value, how then those of us who learn it afterwards can respond and the dangers of that. And so I feel that, you know, if I were reading Chazal and I were learning that there's just differences in value and those differences on Chazal, it leaves more room for subjectivity than the objectivity of difference in halakhic viewpoints that would be dangerous for me in terms of learning out various points of halakha. Well, if this person had that value and that person had that one, well, I don't know, I have my own values, or I agree with those values, and it's more difficult to make it objective, I think.
Okay. I used to present it very much along those kinds of lines, and say that a big issue is whether you're comfortable with the possibility that having played by the rules of the religion perfectly, you still got it really wrong. I think that's an important issue in religious sensibility. Can you, now it has consequences, like whether you can make the claim, well, you know what, there's some people in Chazal said this, and I find that really offensive, but that's okay. Other people in Chazal said this, and they disagreed, so I take that side of Chazal not. Right, that's another, but I think that's the way, I think it is a really valuable psychological insight that for some people, religion is only valuable insofar as it provides certainty. And certainty that you're doing the right thing, that I think people live with a certain amount of uncertainty as to whether you did the right thing or not, that we can say, well, as long as I followed the rules, that's okay. Right? We understand we can be excused if you followed the rules, right? If you followed the rules, you did the wrong thing. But the notion that I spent my life studying Torah, and the end of it, not only did I not do the right thing, but I believe the wrong things about the most central issues in the world, because I followed Rava, and if I had followed up right, and Rava was just wrong, right, Abaye was right, right, and so I got all right that right that way right, and that matters. Like my whole Hashkafas Olam, my whole Weltanschauung, my whole worldview, everything, right, everything is messed up. That's really hard to deal with. I have a lot of sympathy with the understanding of how hard it is to deal with.
there is a counter-religious sensibility, which it, right, which prizes the possibility of real error, and that's right, a sensibility which thinks that dignity is inextricably associated with the capacity for error, right? Because you can't get credit for doing it right unless you could have gotten it wrong. And right, and therefore, right, so let's say, right, if it turns out that in the end it doesn't matter what the halacha is, then there's, right, there's really, I don't understand why one engages so much, right? If it turns out that whether you, that actually whichever way you did is right, so who cares what you, whether you, right, whether you, you know, why should you be passionate about the argument? Either way it turns out fine. But I think it matters very much, that possibility, right, the reason that halachic debates matter so much is because, right, the reason it's worth spending so much time figuring out what the halacha is, because halacha can be right and halacha can be wrong. And if it turns out, if you say elu ve'elu in advance, right, that's right at the Ron's point, if you say elu ve'elu in advance, then all of the machloket b'halacha is just a game. Right, in the end, we'll play the game. We know that both, and we know that we all win. Everybody gets the certificate. All right, there has to be a real possibility of error for halachic disagreement to matter. And by the same token, you could say the same thing, that there has to be a real possibility of error for hashgafic disagreement to matter. What, and at that point, to me, it's a purely semantic question whether you say that there's a disagreement fundamentally as to whether this is valuable, which I think is extremely rare, even cross-culturally, or whether your disagreement is about which value takes priority when they conflict, or which value, right, is more relevant in this context, right? To me, that's a semantic question. I'm perfectly happy to concede the unity of all truth and all values and all that, but I think that if I believe that, right, that when one is, right, given a choice between expressing the recognition of human beings as Tzelem Elokim and expressing the import, let's say, and expressing the importance of distinguishing between the animal and vegetable world, and therefore I decide that recognizing the significance of human beings is the critical issue, and therefore I think that Kvod HaBriyos is Dochashatnes. I'll give you an example, right, where the halacha is going to come the other way, right? And you decide, no, distinguishing the importance between the animal and vegetable world overrides any notion of human dignity, and so tear off the person's clothing in public, right? Because Shatnes beats Kvod HaBriyos, right? Right, that at core we both believe that human dignity is a value and distinguishing the animal and vegetable is a value, right? No, we have a real disagreement, right? A disagreement about priorities. It's not just a disagreement about what to do.
Is that a disagreement about what the values are, or how to balance the values?
It's a disagreement about how to balance, but it's not an unsubstantive disagreement. You're wrong, right? You're not just wrong about what to do, you're wrong if you think
that... But you're wrong about how to balance them, not about what the values are.
Yes, I think everyone, I don't think it's a thing min chazal. I think it's hard to find, you know, people who praise cowardice and denigrate courage as such, right? It's hard to find people who praise cruelty and denigrate kindness, right? On that level, I think, you know, there
isn't
is a one...
Isn't that Nietzsche's whole point, that every society praises the virtues it has?
Every society, but societies generally agree about what virtues are. All societies agree about that. I think no society praises cowardice.
In some situations, they
yes. Situations, right?
Exactly.
But, right, but as the...
Value in cowardice that's applied...
No, right? You know, no one thinks there is a value, right? If we frame it this way, is there a value in being right, in being incapable because, right, because of fear of doing the thing that you believe is right? No, right? So we all, there is a wonderful, how I should point out, there is a wonderful children's poem, right, or storybook called The Most Timid in the Land, right, which is a rabbit society in which cowardice is in fact highly valued, and the way to win the fair princess is to run away fastest, and everyone practices for a long time as a race. In a race.
The other blue race.
Well, no, it's a race. It's just to get as far away as possible. But there's a cynical feminist reading of it, that actually the princess does not wish ever to get married, and it's an infinite race. that may be anachronistic or may not be that. Not clear. But generally, in human societies, we tend to have agreement about that.
What about in situations of like, take Jewish society? Would we actually hold brutality as a value, whereas in clearly, you know, some native societies, and even you, arguably, you know, Nazi Germany, like, brutality.
No, the claim is the capacity to do what is necessary when it is necessary, right? Very few people believe that the willingness to inflict physical harm on other people, lishma, is a value.
I would say that in native, depending on the native culture, but yeah, like brutality and violence is something that.
Interesting. Okay.
Ancient Rome. Yeah. Great example. Gladiators. You know what was the practical? Right? It was just, you know, people were glorifying like these gladiators who could go. What is entertainment?
No, I
have saying something has value and enjoying it. It's saying like, oh, that's great. Being entertained by something means that you hold it as a value. I'm entertained by watching people do kind things to each other. Seriously, if you were to like give him, like here's a sandwich, I'd be like, oh, that's awesome.
I'd be entertained too.
I'd be just entertained if he had a pie in his face.
That means, though, that you hold him being shamed as a value. If I were to actually put a pie in his face right now, and he's like, oh man, now I gotta get changed, I'm embarrassed. Like, when you put this in a real situation...
That's not what a pie does.
It's very
fun. Alright.
Okay.
Somebody throw a pie in your jaw.
Okay, Rob, what did you want to say? Okay, so that's an interesting. I don't know. Are all boxing fans prizing brutality, or is it that they're prizing the capacity to show courage, right? To show courage, right, at the risk of physical harm.
Fair, you can juggle the values and reframe them again and
absolutely
again until you get to a point where you can prove one way or the other. I'm sure you could prove the exact opposite if you continue juggling the values and you could say that everybody actually prizes a different thing. That no, they prize this aspect of some value, this aspect of another value. Nobody actually prizes the same exact value. So it's the more you're going on showing examples, the less I'm compelled, because it's just you're playing around.
So I tend to think, right?
Like his position is as valid as yours, because you can look at it as brutality, or you can look at it as the stylized heroism of the battlefield brought in front of a crowd or something.
Absolutely.
But which elements of that heroism
exactly
are they stressing?
Sure.
And like, if you actually look at a gladiator match, like, it's not, there's not some damsel in distress which they're saving. Like, if they were actually holding that as the greatest value, that would be stressed in the actual portrayal of the gladiator battle.
No, because you're talking about a result-oriented thing. They're prizing character.
Sometimes, like, when a boxer gets up after being hit down, isn't that, like, considered great because it's, like, courage to, like, still get up even after being hurt?
Okay, fine. So that, I'm not saying that courage isn't at all present.
Which is not going to get you.
What
you can always reframe it.
Sure. Okay, Rob, you got to write the same thing that I want to. Yeah.
I don't think we're trying to prove that they balance the values correctly. The question is just, you know, what are the values that are present? Are there values there that are present that are things that we can identify as being things that, in the absence of a contradictory value, would still be sufficiently valuable?
I tend to think that really there is a level at which the perspective that you don't disagree about values is true, but it's not. But I just don't think it's important, because I think what matters is how you prioritize values, and therefore a Dessler statement doesn't matter so much to me. What's significant about Dessler is that he cares. It's important for him to not allow Chazal to dispute among values. For me, I'm okay if nobody has disputes among values, but I don't know that I need to have Chazal agree with each other more than I need everybody else to agree with each other. Right? That to me is the key issue. Right? Is the unanimity that he claims among Chazal different in kind from the unanimity of values that exists broadly among human cultures? I think he's not willing. Right? He wants to claim that Chazal exists in stark contrast to much of the rest of the world, and they exist as a unified group against it. They have values, they share all their values, which those people don't. And I suggest that the reason he does that is because he really, really values certainty.
right? And the notion that you can follow Torah and be wrong is really hard for him. But in context, I don't think Rav Shapiro has that interest at all, and he says almost the exact same thing, right? And I think Moshe points out correctly that you can frame Rav Zetzer in a way which has exactly opposite implications. Right? So we're reading him and seeing if it's fair or not. Yes, Rav?
I'm not sure if it's that he values certainty, or it's that he values that Chazal is a sufficient, complete set of values. I think his biggest concern here is not that Chazal might have balanced things wrong, but that there might be some values that Chazal didn't think of that wouldn't fit into the system.
Okay, that might be also. I'm open to that. So here's where I want to... Here's the connection. Human beings owning their body. Do human beings own their body or not? Can there be a machloket about that? Right? Now, if we say that that's a... Right, if we say that that's... Right, if that idea matters at all, right, then, right, if it says anything that is not, right, that is not platitudinous, right, then for a Dessler, it shouldn't be possible to derive that from one side of a machloket as opposed to the other. The halacha. Because everybody has to agree about it. Okay, so so I want to set out is that the methodology that Rav Zevin uses, right, is really in very harsh contrast with the assumption set out by Rav Dessler, and there are real costs to both sides of it. Right? There's a reason that Rav Dessler wants to say this, right, and that's valuable because it is scary to think that not only that I got, you know, that I might be doing the wrong thing, maybe Shechita is supposed to be on the back of the neck and not the front, right, and I got that wrong, but really doesn't matter very much because after all the whole point is just to make sure there's some standard method of Shechita, right? I'm fine with that. It would have been a little bit better if it had been on the front, on the back instead of the front, but it's okay. But to say I spent my life studying Torah, and I internalized the values of a significant set of Chazal. But bummer, it turned out they were patriarchal. Right? And that's bad, because non-patriarchy is much better. It turned out they were racist, or they were existentialists. Right, and really you're not supposed to be their phenomenologist, right? Whatever philosophic school you want to associate them with about issues that matter. They were virtue ethicists and you're supposed to be an act ethicist. Right? That's a really scary thing. On the other hand, if you can't allow that kind of dispute, then halachic disputes lose a lot of their significance, because then if really everyone agrees about a value, then halachic disputes basically can always be refrained as, but in the end, it's just a question of whether Shechita is in the front of the neck and the back of the neck, and it's just an issue of, is it better to have red mean go and green mean stop, or is it better to have green mean go and red mean stop? Now you might argue that, you know, they can have all sorts of fancy arguments about why it's more important for the stoplight to be visible than the start light, so right, and we can run studies showing which of these colors is more visible at night, right, and that's better. But bottom line is what really matters is that we agree with each other about which one means go and which one means stop. And we might have fights for 30 years about which one, right side of the road, left side of the road, right? But in the end it's just make sure at least in specific locations and even if it's better to drive on the right side or the left, if people go back and forth in England regularly, it would be better if we all agreed about what to do. Because it's scary if you're an American driver in England, all of a sudden with some regularity you notice you're driving on the wrong side of the road. That's bad. So I think there are real costs both ways. And another of the costs which matters a great deal is if you think there can be no disputes. If you think there can be no disputes about values, and if you find a halachic position that seems to reflect a value you really disagree with, you can't say, well, that's wrong because it reflects that value. You have to, right? You can't reject it that ground, because you can't reject a halachic position on the grounds that it reflects a value you disagree with, because it can't. Right? There are no values that you're allowed to disagree with. Right? So those are real costs. Yes, David?
It creates also a problem.
a halakha machloket will start out representing a machloket in values.
Right.
Then one position gets canonized as a halakha, but the value of the machloket still goes on, and so the other side has to find a way to incorporate that halakha into their values.
Sure. Sure. I think that, you know, so I think that I think that's a real issue. Okay, so I want to just head out. Right? I want to set this out as a methodological issue to address, which is one comfortable stating that there are real values disputes in precedent, even in Chazal, right, and certainly later, recognizing the cost of that, which is that if you get it wrong, right, then you get it really, really wrong. But on the other hand, if you claim there can't be, then you lose the option of rejecting positions on those grounds. And the whole mode of analysis of trying to prove a value from a halachic position is impossible if you deny the possibility of machlokasim, right, of machlokasim. Right, the whole notion of deriving philosophy from, right, philosophy from mitzvot, in some ways the whole enterprise of, right, of making religion meaningful, right, becomes impossible in that goal, because there's nothing, right, there's nothing false, right, the only test is does it explain everything. If it doesn't explain everything, then you can't even begin. So I want to raise that question, and as we go through the halachic text next week, where people will, right, Rav Devin emblematically argues that there is in fact a really core issue of value which separates us from other, right, from the Western culture we live in, right, and it's important, and all those positions. Our true position is expressed in these halachic statements, and those other halachic statements are counter to the spirit of Judaism. Right? I realize that makes all sorts of assumptions that carry costs, and we should figure out who's willing to make them. All right. Thank you all very much for a wonderful first week, and I look forward to seeing you all over Shabbos. Good night.